We will go in the order that we have here in the program. So first we'll hear from Dwayne Coleman. Dwayne is a PhD student at the University of Iowa in history. His dissertation examines how Black Civil War veterans and their families utilized the political capital of their service in the war to establish communities in the Midwest. Dwayne is also a co-founder of the Iowa Colored Conventions Digital Project, which explores the essential political role that colored conventions played in the fight for equal citizenship rights for Black people during the 19th century. In the field of Mormon history, Dwayne's research focuses on the relationship that Joseph Smith Jr. and other members of the early church cultivated with their frontier environment, and the role of that environment in the early development of church ideology, practice, and memory. And his talk today is called The Environment and Early Latter-day Saints. Second, we'll hear from Nathan Waite. Nathan is an associate editorial manager for the Church Historians Press, where he helps on the Joseph Smith Papers Project and the new church history series, Saints. He received a BA in English at BYU and an MA in American Studies from the University of Utah, so he can cheer for whoever's winning. He's co-editor of two books, A Zion Canyon Reader, and Settling the Valley, Proclaiming the Gospel, the General Epistles of the Mormon First Presidency. His paper title today is All Concerned Will Profit the Most, John A. Witzo and the Dividing of the Colorado River. Third, we'll hear from Rebecca Anderson, who is a lecturer in modern U.S. history and Utah history at Utah State University. Go Aggies! She oversees the department's public history track and supervises student internships. A graduate of Arizona State University, Anderson's dissertation, Between Mountain and Lake, an Urban Mormon Country, considers the development of a post-World War II Mormon cultural landscape along Utah's Wasatch Front. A recent book chapter, For the Strength of the Hills, Casting a Concrete Zion, looks at the Mormon roots behind Utah's sand and gravel industry, which was published in a recent collection called The Earth Will Appear as the Garden of Eden, Essays on Mormon Environmental History. And fourth, we'll hear from Scott Esplin, who is a professor of church history and doctrine at Brigham Young University, where he also serves as the publications director for the Religious Studies Center. He's the author of numerous studies of Latter-day Saint historic sites and sacred space, including the recent book, Return to the City of Joseph, Modern Mormonism's Contest for the Soul of Nauvoo, which was published by the University of Illinois Press. So we have a great slate of panelists today. Jedediah Rogers will be our commander today. He is the co-editor of the Utah Historical Quarterly and has written on these topics. We're looking forward to his comments as well. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Dwayne Coleman.
Thank you. Many Latter-day Saints trace the beginning of the church to an event known as Joseph Smith's First Vision. Indeed, missionaries for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints share with investigators Joseph Smith's testimony about his visitation from God the Father and Jesus Christ in a grove of trees as the foundation upon which all future lessons rest. Today, this sacred grove, as it is known, is considered hallowed ground by members, many of which make the pilgrimage from around the world to walk among the trees, to sit quietly, and to pray, just as Joseph Smith Jr. did in 1820. Many visitors do this believing that such an environment, touched by the divine, might provide them with their own answers to prayers and personal revelation. With such a pivotal moment as members believe the first vision to be to the restoration of Christ's church on the earth, it is of interest then to examine the setting and environment in which this and other significant events of the formation of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints emerged. As Joseph Smith states, he went to the woods or the wilderness in search of the truth and emerged a changed person. Choosing the environment that he did was no accident or coincidence. As he recounts, this was the place that he had previously designed to go in his attempt to communicate with God. Why then the woods? Smith's parents also frequented these very woods to think and to pray. Maybe it was their example that led him to this place. Or perhaps living in such a busy household, Smith had no other place choice but to seek solitude in the woods. However, in looking at the accounts of other important moments in the history of Joseph Smith Jr. and the church he helped to found, it is apparent that the wilderness environment is not just a happenstance setting, but instead a crucial component to Smith's revelatory process. Nature for Smith was the conduit to God, was his conduit to God. It was the environment he chose most often when he needed revelation, inspiration, and comfort. Time and time again, he sought out what he perceived to be pristine wilderness environments. Examples include the banks of the Susquehanna River, where Smith and Oliver Cowdery, a scribe, reported that they were visited by John the Baptist and received the Aaronic priesthood. Or in the woods near the Peter Whitmer Sr. farm, where three witnesses testified to have seen the gold plates from which the Book of Mormon was translated, as well as an angel, and heard the voice of the Lord. Moreover, before receiving these ancient records, Smith frequented a hill of considerable size near his home in Palmyra, New York, every year for 4 years to speak with heavenly messengers. Time and time again throughout the early history of the church, there is example after example of Joseph Smith and other members of the church interacting with their natural environment in an effort to communicate with God. Historians of early church history have often portrayed the environment as a setting and rarely a vital element in the development of the church's history. The implementation of an environmental history perspective provides a unique lens that allows for a more comprehensive view of the early development of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. This paper explores the crucial role that nature played in the early formation of the church's ideology and religious practices. From Ohio to Missouri, from Illinois to Utah, Latter-day Saints continue to look for the frontier, pushing its boundaries ever further to escape the despotic old world in the hopes of discovering a new pristine environment in which to commune with God. On the borders of the American wilderness, the experiment of a new American religion developed. The environment around Smith and his followers acted as the laboratory in which they would build God's kingdom on earth and themselves be transformed in the process. In Smith's 1832 history, he recounts in rich prose the divine and awe-inspiring impression that the natural environment created in him. Quote, "For I learned in the scriptures that God was the same yesterday, today, and forever, that he was no respecter to persons, for he was God, for I looked upon the sun, the glorious luminary of the earth, and also the moon rolling in their majesty through the heavens, and also the stars shining in their courses, and the earth also upon which I stood, and the beasts of the field, and the fowls of the heaven, and the fish of the waters, and also man walking forth upon the face of the earth in majesty and in the strength of beauty, whose power and intelligence in governing the things which are so exceedingly great and marvelous, even in the likeness of him who created them. And when I considered upon these things, my heart exclaimed, well hath the wise man said, it is a fool that saith in his heart, there is no God." It was this belief in nature's witness of God as an all-powerful, omnipotent being that led Joseph Smith Jr. to the wilderness often to pray. Smith returned many times to the woods and the wilderness in an effort to replicate the revelatory experience that he had in the sacred grove. One example is recorded in a letter sent to his wife Emma in June of 1832. While returning home after engaging in church business in Jackson County, Missouri, Neil K. Whitney suffered a broken leg and ankle during a stagecoach accident. The severity of the injuries required him to remain in the town of Greenville, Indiana, until he could recover enough to make the journey home to Kirtland. Joseph Smith Jr. remained with him during Whitney's 4 long weeks of recovery. Of this time, Joseph later recalled that he experienced homesickness, loneliness, an extreme physical illness from what he believed to be poisoning. During this low period in his life, Smith recorded that he frequently walked in the woods and prayed in the grove near the town where he was staying, all in an effort to soothe his troubled heart and receive comfort and reassurance from God. Indeed, traversing through the woods to ponder and pray became a favorite pastime of Joseph Smith Jr.'s. He continued this relationship with nature and the sublime throughout his life, as evidenced in his journals and the accounts of others. Lucy Mack Smith recalled of her son's remark to her on one occasion that, quote, "I can take my Bible and go into the woods and learn more in 2 hours than you can learn at meeting in 2 years if you should go all the time," close quote. During his time in Nauvoo, Smith frequently rode his favorite horse, along with Emma, into the woods and countryside around Nauvoo to ponder and to pray.
For those followers and others of the period, Smith's recounting of his experience in the woods or wilderness would have rung true for many of those familiar with the Bible and its many examples of prophets and their spiritual experiences in the wilderness. For example, Jacob wrestled with an angel in the wilderness. Moses heard God in a burning bush in the wilderness of Sinai. John the Baptist preached and baptized in the wilderness on the banks of the Jordan River. And Jesus fasted 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness before his public ministry, as the scriptures tell us. The Book of Mormon is also replete with such examples as Enos, Lehi, and Nephi, and the brother of Jared. Even Joseph Smith's Puritan progenitors who came to the American wilderness during the Great Migration did so as a way to get closer to God and raise up out of what they perceived to be a pristine primordial wilderness, a pure society and people uncorrupted by sinful man. In this way, Smith's penchant for seeking revelation in the wilderness was nothing new. Indeed, we see other contemporary examples like that of transcendentalist Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau, both of Puritan stock as well, who likewise espouse the individual's ability to find truth in the nature around them. Smith's use of nature in his communications with God may have been yet another sign to many of his divine calling. As William Cronin explains, at the core of the concept of wilderness lies the deepest core values of our culture, where the religious and supernatural lie just beneath the surface. Here in the rare sublime landscape, romantics like Burke, Kant, Gilpin, and others could glimpse the face of God. The wilderness was, in effect, God's cathedral. This new American religion, born during the Romantic period, adopted many of the period's characteristics. The beliefs and practices of the church did not originate as a fully actualized theology and organization, but developed both out of the secular world from which it came and the new wilderness that it inhabited. Members took within the truths they held dear and attempted to reimagine a new and purer world in the wilderness. Smith and his followers experienced revelation in various ways through the wilderness environment. It was for them as if the very dust of the earth were speaking to them, sharing with them the revelations that God would have them know. In a letter to his wife Emma, Smith remarked upon the way the environment influenced him during an expedition to assist those saints evicted from their lands in Jackson County, Missouri in 1834. In it, he describes the beauty of the land and the spiritual impressions it made upon him, saying, quote, "The contemplation of the scenery around us produced peculiar sensations in our bosoms," close quote. He further explained that the visions of the past were also open to his understanding by, quote, "the Spirit of the Almighty." The rocks, the trees, and even the Indian mounds with human remains held a message to share with the saints. Joseph Smith and other members of the church were continually looking for signs from God in the environment around them. Indeed, Smith's journals, church publications like the Times and Seasons and Histories of the Church are historical records of some of the natural events and disasters that happened both in the U.S. and abroad during the early years of the church. Events such as deadly earthquakes, floods, and cholera outbreaks were all signs of God's growing wrath over a sinful world. One example of the spiritual implications that Smith and others gave to natural events occurred on November 13th, 1833. The peoples of North America were witness to a dramatic and awe-inspiring light show in the heavens. Smith recorded that, quote, "About 4 o'clock a.m., I was awakened by Brother Davis knocking at my door and calling on me to arise and behold the signs in the heavens. I arose, and to my great joy, I beheld the stars fall from heaven like a shower of hailstones, a literal fulfillment of the word of God as recorded in the Holy Scriptures, and a sure sign that the coming of Christ is close at hand. In the midst of this shower of fire, I was led to exclaim, 'How marvelous are thy works, O Lord!'" Close quote. Smith was not the only one to view the heavenly light show as a sign from heaven. Parley P. Pratt made a similar observation, as did other contemporaries like Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, who viewed the meteor shower as a sign that God's judgment on the people and the end of slavery was soon at hand. Even Abraham Lincoln, years later, recalled the spiritual interpretations that individuals around him took concerning this natural event. 4 days after the amazing light show, Smith recorded in his journal his disappointment that no other biblical events of note had yet occurred. Scientists today have postulated that the event that Joseph Smith and thousands of others saw on that November night was in fact a meteor shower known as the Leonid meteor shower. Such natural signs as this and others were discussed by members of the church in the streets, during meetings, from the pulpit during general conferences. As millennialists, Smith and other members of the church saw the events as signs of the second coming of the Lord. They used these signs from God through nature as they perceived them to be, as evidence of their chosen place in God's kingdom, and as a proselyting tool to encourage others to repent of their sins and prepare for the kingdom of God before it was too late. Smith reinforced these ideas of God's communication with his chosen people in various settings. During Zion's camp, Smith was inspired by the beauty and nature around him and the Indian mounds they passed, even going so far as to use the remains found in one mound to teach and exhort his followers to repent and remain steadfast in their trials. During the same expedition, he taught his followers to respect and care for nature by preventing the abuse of a dog in the camp by Sylvester Smith and the killing of snakes that wandered into some of the tents. Smith counseled the men, saying, quote, "Let them alone. Don't hurt them. How will the serpent ever lose its venom while the servants of God possess the same disposition and continue to make war upon it?" Close quote. He further instructed them to become harmless before the brute creation. Then and only then would the lamb and the lion lie down together. Brigham Young, endeavoring to be diligent in following Smith's counsel to respect and care for nature, removed two rattlesnakes that had wandered into his tent with his bare hands and placed them safely outside the camp. In conjunction with living in harmony with nature, Smith also believed in shaping the wilderness in preparation for Christ's second coming and millennial reign. Like his Puritan forebears, the wilderness was beautiful and bountiful and also dangerous and in need of taming. As such, Smith and his followers attempted to build the city of Zion in Jackson County, Missouri, and later cities like Nauvoo and Salt Lake were attempts at making nature more useful to man, and also in accordance with God's commandment to Adam and Eve and their posterity to subdue the earth and have dominion over all things that move on the face thereof. The creation of cities was not an attempt to exclude the natural environment from civilization, but instead to tame and keep that which was most helpful and useful to man. The Smith's cities represent an attempt to merge the two worlds. In Nauvoo, Smith and his followers plotted the land in one-acre parcels, upon which families were encouraged to raise livestock, plant herbal as well as ornamental gardens and orchards, both to invigorate the body and gladden the soul. The close proximity of farmlands to the city demonstrates both the practicality but also the interconnected environment they wished to create between the city and the country. Indeed, the very homes and buildings they constructed were a product of their environment. Indeed, the beautiful red brick homes of which Nauvoo is known for today was the result of the mineral content of the local clay used. The wooden structures of Nauvoo were built from the lumber acquired on the Wisconsin frontier. The stone from which the temple and the cultural hall were built were from a granite quarry on the outskirts of town. Even the very placement of the temple on the bluff overlooking the Mississippi, as well as the decor of the temple adorned with sunstones, stars, and moons, were intended to be both aesthetically pleasing integrations into the landscape, as well as inspire cosmic awe and instill in the beholder a reverence for God, for God's work. Even after the majority of the saints left Nauvoo, the city remained a favorite stop along the Mississippi. Henry David Thoreau, one of these later visitors, appreciated the vision that the saints had in building their city in the wilderness. He remarked upon the singularity of Nauvoo on the Mississippi, saying, "As I worked my way up the river in the light of today, and gazed on the fresh ruins of Nauvoo, I felt that this was the heroic age itself. Indeed, the people of Nauvoo did not just alter the environment around them, but integrated themselves into it." Still, there were many aspects of the environment that were beyond Joseph Smith and the members of the church's ability to control and subdue. While the saints undertook a significant irrigation project to drain the swamp that was Nauvoo, they still had to contend both before its completion and after with diseases common along the Mississippi. Malaria, ague, as well as dysentery were common causes of sickness and death in Nauvoo during the entirety of the Saints' stay. The geography of Nauvoo, set in a low-lying position in conjunction with the bluffs above the city, meant the constant inundation of water in Nauvoo as a result of the watershed effect. The standing water prevalent in Nauvoo's low-lying position made it a prime breeding ground for the proliferation of malaria-carrying mosquitoes. Disease and death was a constant reality for these early settlers. Joseph Smith lost several family members and friends during this period, including his father, the patriarch of the church. With sickness rampant, Joseph and others attempted to use the environment around them to heal and comfort the saints. Joseph encouraged the use of herbs for medicinal purposes, and they also performed ritual washings and baptisms in the Mississippi River in the hopes of healing those afflicted. Some have estimated the deaths of those in Nauvoo during this period between 25 and 35 per 1,000. In the midst of this suffering, a consequence of the natural environment that they inhabited, emerged revelations to the church, which would change the very practice, mission, and ideology. Indeed, some of the most consequential doctrinal summations given by Joseph Smith occurred during or soon after funerals. The doctrine of baptisms for the dead were revealed to those present at the funeral of Seymour Brunson in August of 1840. And during Smith's Ken Follett discourse in 1844, he expounded upon the nature of God and man's relation to him. Such sermons were intended to soothe troubled minds and hearts and encourage them to continue in the faith to build up the kingdom of God on earth. After learning that they could perform baptisms on behalf of departed loved ones, hundreds of saints engaged in eager to conquer their despair, began performing baptisms in the Mississippi River. Smith then redirected this enthusiasm to build the temple that was then under construction. It is in this context of loss and sickness that Smith expounded upon the teaching of celestial marriage and the sealing power of the priesthood, both for time and eternity, now foundational teachings of the church. Thus, the development and ready reception of such doctrines by members of the church in Nauvoo was crucially influenced by the environment that the saints inhabited. The few examples I have shared concerning the influence of the environment in the development of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, as well as many others, deserve further exploration. Even after the martyrdom of the prophet Joseph Smith Jr. and Hiram Smith, the patriarch, the saints continued to look for signs in and be influenced by their environment. Whether it was in what they perceived to be their miraculous preservation when the Mississippi River froze over, allowing the saints to cross on foot during the exodus from Nauvoo, or when quail fell from the sky on the Iowa side of the Mississippi, providing much-needed nourishment for the most bereft saints, or when seagulls preserved their crops from ravenous locusts in the Salt Lake Valley, or in the settlement practices which utilized and transformed the arid landscapes around them through irrigation projects and agriculture, the saints continued to see God in their environment. From the first vision to the present day, where members continue to seek their own revelatory experiences by visiting the sacred grove, the ruins of old Nauvoo, or the Hill Cumorah, the history and ideology of the church, whether they realize it or not, is in no small part a product of the environment. Thank you.
Transporting water from where it naturally flows and pools to where it can be better used for household and agricultural use is the foundation of the American West as we know it today. Unlike the eastern half of the United States and much of its western coast, the stretch in between does not generally get enough precipitation to sustain human life. Water has been captured, and water has to be captured and stored by dams so it can be released into canals and aqueducts at a steady, sustainable rate rather than at the seasonal flood or trickle rate that naturally occurs in a western waterway. Constructing dams and canals to put barren land to use is called reclamation. The largest and most important river system in the southwestern United States is the Colorado River, which starts up in the Rocky Mountains, makes its way down to the Colorado Plateau, through the Mojave and Sonoran deserts, and then ultimately ends up in the Sea of Cortez, or at least it did until Lake Powell was created by the Glen Canyon Dam, after which water has only rarely reached the sea. Up until the 1920s, only modest amounts of water had been diverted from the upper half of the Colorado, and the major diversions in the lower half to the dry but extremely fertile valleys in extreme southern California. That's the Imperial Valley. That area faced a threat of flood damage every year. In 1921, the lower river basin, the states in the lower river basin, that's Arizona, Nevada, and California, started calling for a large-scale dam to regulate the flow. And when Congress signaled a willingness to build such a structure, the upper basin states of Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, and Utah objected, fearful that under existing water law, if the lower states put more and more Colorado River water use, they would have rights to that water forever, leaving the upper states high and dry. Rather than waiting for the federal government to take control of the problem, the states agreed to reach a compromise by forming a Colorado River Commission in 1922, which was chaired by U.S. Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover. This is a picture of the commission. My paper examines John Widsoe's role as an advisor to the Colorado River Commission. His modest contributions made a difference at key moments, and his fierce advocacy for reclamation of desert lands, founded in his Latter-day Saint worldview, helped frame the discussions and outcomes of the commission. That advocacy has contributed to the exponential growth of the American West, bringing prosperity which Widsoe foresaw and environmental crisis which presumably he did not. In 1922, the U.S. Geological Survey estimated the total flow of the Colorado, including all its tributaries, to be 17.6 million acre-feet a year. That's a lot of water. An acre-foot is the amount of water it takes to cover an acre of land in a foot of water. So an Olympic swimming pool is about 2 acre-feet, and 17.6 million acre-feet is 5.7 trillion gallons of water. The USGS also prepared tables calculating the maximum acres of land each state could reasonably place under irrigation. Since the projections forecast more than enough water for all the states, federal officials may have hoped for an easy outcome. The first meetings of the Colorado River Commission broke down, however, as delegates disputed the federal government's numbers, worried that their own state's potential had been underestimated. As historian Norris Hundley put it, faced with uncertainty, they adopted the only safe approach. They claimed an amount great enough to offset their fears. The next step for the commission was a series of hearings in representative cities throughout the basin, including in Salt Lake City. Prior to the hearing, Utah's delegate to the commission, State Engineer R.E. Caldwell, got permission to invite John A. Widsoe to join compact discussions as an advisor to the state. Caldwell was motivated in part by his loyalty to his Latter-day Saint faith, it appears, as he wrote to Widsoe that, quote, the church might be interested in having you join discussions. Widsoe accepted the invitation and considered his participation on the commission to be, quote, one of the real opportunities of my life. John Widsoe had recently been ordained to the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles. He was one of the church's brightest minds and had served as president of both what became Utah State University and the University of Utah. Widsoe's foremost passion was reclamation, and he was a sought-after authority on irrigation. His experience as a 19th and early 20th century Latter-day Saint made him a firm believer in the idea that his people's divine mission was to make the desert blossom as the rose. To Widsoe, wasting water didn't mean leaving the tap running while you brushed your teeth. It meant letting the Weber River run into the Great Salt Lake without capturing every last drop for some kind of improvement. Widsoe's approach to the Colorado River Compact matched his larger philosophy. Rather than play favorites with any state, even his own, he wanted the water to be put to maximum and most beneficial use, period. Of the existing water law, he very much preferred what's called a prior appropriation, meaning that whoever developed use for a certain amount of water first got rights to that water. Widsoe saw prior appropriation as fundamental to successful irrigation in the West because it incentivized and rewarded growth and development. In notes scribbled during his trip to a commission hearing in Southern California, he wrote that the compact ought to allow unrestricted development by all states for the next 50 years, and that by doing so, quote, all concerned will profit the most. Widsoe made that exact recommendation when called on to testify at the Salt Lake City hearing in March 1922. Unlike others, he trusted the government's numbers, and his own experience taught him that a large portion of the water used for agriculture seeped into the ground and made its way back to the river as the return flow. Thus, the same acre-feet of water could be used again and again. In his speech, Widsoe reminded the commission that the Mormons had first brought successful widespread irrigation to the West and had done it with an eye toward cooperation and the common good. It will be a lasting glory, he declared, if a compact or treaty, freed from selfish interests and based upon scientific principles, should result from these hearings and the deliberations of the commission. The Colorado River offers indeed an adventure in the conquest of nature for the good of man, worthy of the best traditions of this far western land." End quote. Not everyone was enthused with the testimony. Salt Lake City engineer publicly excoriated Widsoe's failure to defend Utah's imperiled water rights, warning that California and Arizona were far ahead in their ability to tap the Colorado's waters. This writer predicted that after the 50 years of unrestricted development that Widsoe had called for, Utah, quote, will have before it a comprehensive development on the lower Colorado with a probable restraining order by the Supreme Court of the United States against similar development in the upper basin, end quote. Oh, going on. If Widsoe, quote, had been the commissioned advocate for the lower Colorado River interests, he complained, he could not have done more in their behalf. That summer, Widsoe joined a river expedition through Glen Canyon with other commission representatives, but that will have to be a story for another day. Herbert Hoover was determined to make the commission meeting held in November 1922 the last, and he set the meeting in a small retreat off the beaten path outside Santa Fe, New Mexico, meaning that for the most part, each state could have only two representatives present. It goes without saying, but ought to be said, that all of the commission participants were men and all were white. Mexican interests were deliberately barred from discussions to be settled at a later time, and tribal water rights were tacked onto the compact seemingly as an afterthought. Widsoe's diary entries for the meetings in Santa Fe were terse, but hint at interminable meetings and days of stalemate. Little accomplished, no results, fruitless, and my favorite, attended movie show. Once it was agreed on that the water would not be divided by the compact state by state, but between the upper basin and the lower basin, the problem came down to the two lower basin states with the most to gain or lose. Arizona held out for as much advantage against gargantuan California as it could muster. After 5 days of meetings, Hoover canceled the Wednesday afternoons and evening sessions to try and seek an agreement by working privately with smaller groups. That evening, he sought Widsoe out specifically and dined alone with him to discuss allocation strategies. Later that evening, in a conversation with all the Upper Basin state delegates in Caldwell and Widsoe's shared hotel room, Widsoe won preliminary approval for a set of principles for the compact. The following morning, at the next formal session, all the states agreed to the principles, and Widsoe departed for home, not waiting for the lawyers to draft the details. Weeks later, when Herbert Hoover sent John Widsoe the final text of the compact, he was pleased to tell Widsoe that, quote, it represents very closely the ultimate lines which you and I discussed, end quote, signaling that Widsoe did in fact play a role in the final points of the compact. In the end, Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, and New Mexico would share half the river, or 7.5 million acre-feet a year, and Arizona, Nevada, and California would share 7.5 million and be given rights to a million more acre-feet originating in Arizona. So what of Widsoe's ideas, at least those that he committed to paper, made it into the final compact? Widsoe had called for unrestricted development of the river by all states for 50 years. But the final result, apportioning the river to two halves of the basin, in Widsoe's mind secured the same right, because Utah, he believed, could not develop its full allotment for decades to come. In fact, he was right. Utah still hasn't developed its full water right, and state officials are trying to build a pipeline from Lake Powell to St. George to use more of our allotment. Following Widsoe's emphasis on use rather than ownership of water, Article 3E of the compact prohibited states from storing their full allotment of water if they cannot use it. In other words, if there was surplus because the upper states could not yet use all 7.5 million acre feet, then the lower states could use that water unless and until the upper states could. California has since grabbed this surplus, which coupled with the drought conditions of the last decades has led to the shortages of today. Widsoe had also argued from the start that agriculture was the water's highest possible use and must trump power production or other uses, and that prioritization is reflected in Article 4B of the compact. To become law, the compact had to be ratified by all seven basin states. All the states but Arizona quickly did so. The final voting in the Arizona Senate appeared to be coming down 10-9 in favor of attaching conditions to Arizona's ratification, which many believed would be a fatal blow to the compact, because if Arizona demanded specific rights, then Colorado or Wyoming or California would do the same, and we'd be back to square one. The whole compact rested on a single Arizona senator's vote. Hoover, through his secretary, leveraged Widsoe's ecclesiastical clout as a top Mormon leader and urged Widsoe to lean on Thomas Kimball, a Latter-day Saint Arizona senator. Widsoe did what he could, sending Kimball two pointed telegrams telling him it was time to support the compact. Widsoe's attempts did not carry the day, and the Arizona legislature ultimately rejected ratification altogether. What followed was a compact agreed on by six states instead of seven, years of resistance by Arizona demanding greater rights to the point of posting an armed navy on the river. That's it, that's the whole navy. To try and stop the building of Parker Dam. And finally, three support three Supreme Court rulings, the last of which gave Arizona the water it wanted, but also gave the federal government much of the control of the law of the river that states had so feared. So after it was written, or soon after it was written, Widso praised the Colorado River Compact as, quote, so much better than the best we could have hoped for. As companion laws went into effect to build the Hoover Dam, Widso celebrated. Controlling nature on such a vast scale was satisfying to him professionally and spiritually. Widso's faith in God was inextricably bound up with his faith in science. He was certain that God had blessed men to bring forth scientific advancements, even those that seemed horrific, for their benefit and happiness. In looking upon the atomic bomb with clear eyes, he declared in one sermon that was later published, "We know what to do. It must be used as God would use it, for we are his very children. The acceptance of the word of God will make the atomic bomb our humble servant to beautify the life of man on earth." In Widso's theology, humankind was to use science to ascend to the level of God. Mother Nature was to be harnessed and subdued, battled until she gave up her resources for humankind's maximum beneficial use. For his contribution to the centennial celebration of the pioneers' journey west in 1847, Widso penned an entire book lauding their conquering of the desert, their winning, quote, "the first real battle of the pioneers, the battle with aridity." He concluded, "The pioneers believed that to man is given the power to compel nature to serve, if only human powers are applied intelligently and diligently." Widso expanded on this idea in his internationally distributed textbook, Success on Irrigation Projects, published in 1928. Quote, "The destiny of man is to possess the whole earth. The destiny of the earth is to be subject to man. There can be no full conquest of the earth and no real satisfaction to humanity if large portions of the earth remain beyond his highest control," end quote. I found that not in Widso's writings, but in the writings of Wallace Stegner, another Western writer, much more environmentally minded, and you can imagine that he had some harsh words for that sentiment. Taming and putting to use the Colorado River was essential to fulfilling Widso's dream. He could afford to be nonpartisan and speak in favor of California or Arizona's water development alongside Utah, because it all represented the blossoming of the desert, the conquering of arid land, and bringing it into productive use. It worked too well, as the exploding population in the West has demonstrated. Coupled with what appears to be the new normal of hotter, drier conditions, this is Lake Mead with the white line above showing the high water mark and the current water much lower. This year, the extra water will help, but not solve the overall crisis. So it has been left to later generations to figure out how to do more with less water. Adding in the concerns for ecosystems, wilderness, non-human basin inhabitants, and water quality will make the next chapter of reckoning with the Colorado River a greater challenge than even those of Widso's day. Thank you.
So shortly after his call as president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in January 2018, Russell M. Nelson made the kind of now famous announcement for the need to refer to the church by its full name. And in fact, the church's style guide now states that media and others are not to use the term Mormon and Mormonism when referring to its members, or, quote, "the combination of doctrine, culture, and lifestyle unique to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints." And when I first heard that announcement, it caused a lot of reflection, as I'm sure it did many of you. And as historians have been quick to point out, initially that the term Mormon was obviously a derogatory term critics and enemies applied to Latter-day Saints, which then was proudly appropriated by church members themselves. And I'd kind of like to expand our understanding of this term today by carrying the historical usage of the term into mid-20th century, when artists, writers, and scholars, building on the popularity of local color writers, started regionalist movements across the United States. And regionalists sought to create a sense of national unity by celebrating geographically distinct cultures and traditions. And so for these writers, the term Mormon became an important modifier to really describe this people, but most importantly, a place. And where Utah Mormons had once been the object of scrutiny, even antagonism, regionalists could now celebrate these Mormons as something unique and special. And increasingly, they started to look at the Utah's high Colorado Plateau country as sort of the authentic place where Mormons would be found. So in this paper, I analyze an early example of local color writing from Florence Merriam's My Summer in a Mormon Village, published in 1894, Zane Grey's novel The Heritage of the Desert, 1910, and Wallace Stegner's Mormon Country, very famous book, 1942. And I look at how these authors use the land as an important metaphor to communicate a particular perception of Mormon values and cultures to the wider reading public. And so kind of moving on to Florence Merriam, she visited, we're pretty sure her book is based on her time spent in Bountiful, Utah. She was there shortly after the church had ended its practice of polygamy, and her descriptions of the village certainly paralleled those of earlier travel writers. But there is a nostalgic quality to her work in that she recognizes that with the end of polygamy, change is going to be coming to this community. And while she certainly does not condone polygamy in any way, she does have some really interesting descriptions of nature in Bountiful that she uses as a way to kind of make a bridge between her reading audience and Mormons and kind of in such a way that would encourage empathy. So she liked to take a lot of evening walks along the bench, and she liked the sunset and observing that sunset, and she has several very flowery descriptions of the sunset. But on one evening, she writes, "Above us on the bench, a horn blew out, a joyous, exultant blast. Gradually, the rainbow colors faded and the flaming crowd streamers melted away. A hush fell over all, and in the twilight calm, the beautiful old hymn, 'Nearer, my God, to thee,' came softly from the horn on the hillside. The peace of the fading sunset had come to the Mormon lad in the one beautiful yearning prayer in which Mormon and Gentile joined with uplifted souls." And so here I interpreted that quote as the shared experience in nature provided the perfect opportunity for Merriam and her readers to find common ground with a people largely shunned by the outside world. In contrast, in looking at Zane Grey's writings, in particular his first Western that really starts to define the genre, The Heritage of the Desert, he uses the Southwest desert landscape and environment, again, to communicate characters' core values. Grey is often controversial because some of his Mormon characters are fairly, you know, they're kind of the bad guys sometimes in his books. And Gary Toppings has demonstrated, quote, "Even in the seemingly most harshly anti-Mormon novels, Grey always does use these good Mormon characters. And perhaps that is because, as Grey writes, all Western men developed by hard contact with the desert are great, whether they are good or bad." And so this is particularly the case in this book. The book tells about the story of an injured young cowboy, John Hare. He's rescued by August Knapp, a Mormon cattle rancher. They live kind of in southern Utah along the Arizona Strip. Knapp has troubles of his own with his alcoholic son, Snap, and the Gentile rancher, Rustler Holderness, threatens Knapp's peaceful life there. Over the course of the book, Hare also falls in love with Miska, a part Navajo woman Knapp has raised from childhood, but who is destined to become Snap's second wife. In the end, despite his peace-loving ways, Knapp has to confront Holderness, and in the end, Hare and Miska end up together. But it's in his descriptions of the desert and how he talks about his characters that this idea of Mormons and the land and the descriptions of Mormons kind of comes to the fore. So for Grey, the desert is where the true contest of life plays out. And he writes, "The creatures of the desert endured the sun and lived without water and were at endless war." And so if the law of the desert is this always internal Darwinian struggle, Gray's characters partake of the desert in different ways. So he writes, "Holderness had the amber clearness of its distance in his eyes, its deceit in his soul. August Knapp, the magnificence of the desert pine in his giant form, its strength in his heart. Snap Knapp, the cast of the hawk beast beak in his face, its cruelty in his nature. But all shared alike in the common element of survival ferocity." And indeed, in Grey's estimation, and it kind of comes out pretty clearly in this book, Mormons may have been the only settlers truly capable to survive in the desert. In turn, the relentless drive itself is born of the desert. And he talks about in fact, August Knapp is sort of the quintessential Mormon because he's able to do anything in this desert land. He's able to tame it. He's a blacksmith, a mechanic, a carpenter, a cooper, a potter. So this is kind of the point that Gray is making here. In the years following Gray's memorable Westerns, sociologists like Lori Nelson and others, they started kind of looking critically at Mormon villages all the way from Cardston to Canaraville. And Wallace Stegner's work is really an outgrowth of this. And his famous Mormon Country, published in 1942, was actually part of Erskine Caldwell's edited Folkway series. And this is a high point, I feel, in regional writing that popularized Latter-day Saint lifeways for a wider reading public. And in the book, Stegner uses the physical environment not as a scenic backdrop, but he is a way to communicate his underlying assumptions about Mormons. So early in the book, there's a piece, very famous piece, called Mormon Trees, in which he uses Lombardy poplars as a metaphor for Mormon community life, obedience, and devotion. So he writes, "Perhaps it is fanciful to judge a people by its trees. Probably it is pure nonsense to see a reflection of Mormon group life in the fact that poplars were practically never planted singly, but always in groups, and that groups and those groups took the form straight lines and ranks, a marching row of plumed poplars was symbolic somehow of the planters walking with God and his solidarity with his neighbors." And then he noted that the kind of extending this metaphor further, that each succeeding Mormon generation looks heavenward, but their roots are in the earth. And so connected to land this way, Stegner is adamant that, quote, "Mormondom is a social and religious, not a topographical entity, but that also Latter-day Saints are unique in their way of imposing their views on the land." And in particular, it's clear in this book that the truly authentic Mormon country is, quote, "in the villages, in the Colorado Plateau country, where, quote, the villages are hidden in the canyons and under the cliffs. There is nothing visible but the torn and slashed and wind-worn beauty of absolute wasteland. If you are a Mormon waiting for the trump of the last days while you labor in building the kingdom, you can be excused for expecting that those last days will come any time now. The world is dead and disintegrating before your eyes." In a radio spot that he appeared on shortly after the book came out, the hosts were talking about, you know, will this regionalism in the United States survive after World War II? And Stegner was kind of, he said that he thought it would, and he even went so far as to suggest that Mormon country, where he wrote, actually might provide a model that the post-war United States might survive or might utilize in kind of navigating this post-war world, because Mormons are unified and they're able to build and survive in harsh environments. So during the early to mid-20th century, members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints gradually found a place within American society. This assimilation acceptance was the result of multiple factors, one of which, what I'm arguing, is the regionalist impulse that swept American writers and artists during these same years. Regionalists celebrated the unique and the different, often linking these happy distinctions to the land itself. They celebrated Mormons and Mormonism first with the local color writers like Florence Merriam, who used the land as an important bridge, connecting the reading public with an otherwise suspicious people, to the writers like Zane Grey and Wallace Stegner, who saw the land as an important metaphor for the people themselves. Mormons sacrificed much. Their strict obedience allowed them to build communities in places no one else wanted. They shaped the land in their image, but partook of its raw intensity. And so kind of going back to the genesis of this paper, which was the kind of the emphasis on the name, as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints increasingly identifies as a global faith, What better way to emphasize its denominational identity than to abandon a historical moniker like Mormon with its associated narrow place-based connections? But at the same time, and this kind of carries us beyond, you know, I'll have to write another paper on this, I guess. At the same time, though, if you look at the way in which the church uses its history, the lessons that it hopes to draw from that history are lessons of faith, sacrifice, and obedience. And these kind of themes are even kind of integrated into how the church is even presenting its global history right now. And what it may be forgetting, but all of those kind of values writers have historically tied to Mormons and their ties to this land, that the land itself grants these kind of qualities. So at the same time that the church uses its pioneer history of faith, sacrifice, and obedience as an all-encompassing narrative for the global church, what it may be forgetting, but what the regionalists knew, was the power of the land itself in giving expression and shape to these identity markers, which for mid-20th century writers and their readers could be best encompassed in one simple term, Mormon.
Thank you, Dwayne, Nathan, and Rebecca. I enjoyed your papers and look forward to mine being over as well. Mine is an attempt to look at the federal agency that is charged with preserving, in the United States at least, the role of nature. Throughout much of the 20th century, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints acquired and developed sites in an effort to reverse the effects of earlier isolation in the West by integrating with national narratives, as Rebecca has mentioned. The development of these sites brought the faith into collaboration with public and private organizations, including the National Park Service, who had similar interests in celebrating American accomplishment. Charged with preserving unimpaired the natural and cultural resources of the United States, the National Park Service has an expansive mission that often intersects with the interests of private groups like the church. Designating historic sites for preservation can be controversial, especially when it overlaps with religious history. This paper examines the involvement of the church and with the federal government, primarily through the National Park Service directors Conrad Wirth and George Hartzog, in the designation and preservation of Latter-day Saints' sacred space. It explores the support provided for the development of church historic sites, as well as the reasons the partnership was dissolved. A formal preservation of natural and historic space within the United States by the federal government began in 1872, when Yellowstone National Park was designated as a public park or pleasuring ground for the benefit and enjoyment of the people, and placed under exclusive control of the Secretary of the Interior. Expanding the reach of the federal government, the Antiquities Act of 1906 granted the President of the United States authority to designate historic landmarks, historic and prehistoric structures, and other objects of historic interest as national monuments. The National Park Service, a federal bureau under the direction of the Department of the Interior, was formed in 1916 by the Organic Act. This legislation dictated that the service shall promote and regulate the use of the federal areas known as national parks, monuments, and reservations, and leave them unimpaired for the enjoyment of future generations. The Historic Sites Act of 1935 significantly expanded the Park Service area of focus, declaring, quote, that it is a national policy to preserve for public use historic sites and buildings and objects of national significance for the inspiration and benefit of the people of the United States. At present, more than 100 years after its founding, the National Park Service manages an extensive network of over 400 properties, including parks, monuments, trails, sites, and recreation areas. In a country founded by religiously motivated settlers that enshrined freedom of religion, it is inevitable that the federal agency charged with preserving and celebrating the nation's history would overlap with faith. Several sites that are part of the national park system have a connection to faith through the history they preserve. While America's story includes actors and actions that are significantly religious, not all of the historically religious sites are directly owned by the federal government. Importantly, the Historic Sites Act of 1935 charged the National Park Service to contract and make cooperative agreements with states, municipal subdivisions, corporations, associations, or individuals to protect, preserve, maintain, or operate any historic or archaeological building, site, object, or property used in connection therewith for public use. As a result, partnerships between church and state exist, like this one, Boston's Old North Church, allowing for federally supported historical designation and even sharing of religious space. This includes Latter-day Saint historical sites across the country. Federal interest in the historic sites of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints emerged during the early decades of the National Park Service. The interest coincided with significant focus on site development by the federal government in the years immediately after the 20th century's two world wars. A flourishing of park-centered patriotism coincided with Latter-day Saint interest in emerging from its mountain exile to step out onto this national stage. Through participation in the nation's politics, its armed conflicts, and its commemorations, Latter-day Saints sought to establish significance on the stage of American discourse. Memorials to a shared past, as Kathleen Flake described them, signaled the church's intent to come out from behind its mountain barrier and claim a place in America at large. During the early decades of the 20th century, the church acquired and developed properties in Sharon, Vermont, Palmyra, New York, and Carthage, Illinois, as a way to stake a claim to the telling of its own story. The use of national parks and historic sites for patriotic political purposes was repeated following World War II, a time when Americans flocked to the parks in greater numbers, and the Park Service had few resources to deal with them. This coincided with the golden age of American family vacations, when Cold War fears contrasted with robust consumerism in a summertime tradition of crisscrossing the country on its expanding federal highways. Conrad Wirth, the country's longest tenured National Park Service director, developed Mission 66, an ambitious 10-year agenda aimed at celebrating the system's 50th year jubilee in 1966 by revamping a park program that had become woefully overrun while simultaneously neglected through underfunding. Historic Nauvoo, Illinois, was a place where God, patriotism, and pioneers came together for Conrad Wirth. Throughout the 1950s and 60s, private individuals like Wilford Wood, Lane K. Newberry, and J. Leroy Kimball, as well as organizations including the State of Illinois and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, explored the idea of developing historic Nauvoo. In May 1962, representatives from these parties gathered in Nauvoo to consider the possibility. Joining Presidents Henry D. Moyle and Hugh B. Brown of the Church's first presidency, A. Edwin Kendrew, Senior Vice President and Chief Historical Architect for the Restoration of Colonial Williamsburg, J. Leroy Kimball, Visionary Restorer of Nauvoo's Heber C. Kimball Home, and J. Willard Marriott, Hotel Developer and Entrepreneur, was Conrad Wirth, Director of the National Park Service, who is pictured on the right. As the party toured Nauvoo's surviving historical structures from its Latter-day Saint past, the group discussed possibilities for a restored future. Of interest to the National Park Service, the fact-finding mission aimed to discover the possibilities for the restoring of historical significance of Nauvoo as one of the major bases of overland migration from Mississippi into the American West. This interest in Nauvoo was an important national historic site extended beyond Wirth's high-profile visit to the city. Even before Wirth's visit, the National Park Service had been actively exploring Nauvoo as a site of national significance. Studying overland migrations west of the Mississippi River, the Park Service settled on the story of the Latter-day Saints and, by association, Nauvoo. Quote, "The fifth decade of the 19th century was America's most expansive period," a Park Service report concluded under the authority of the Historic Sites Act noted. "Within the space of a few years, the boundaries of the United States were pushed across half the continent. The most significant aspect of this expansion was the overland movement of the immigrants. The optimistic pioneer farmer, moving with his family to Oregon, the persevering Mormon, searching for a home in which he might live in peace, and the adventurous 49er, hurrying to the new El Dorado with visions of the wealth that awaited him there, all carried American civilization westward and building in the Great West the foundations for a new society." As a result of the report, the National Park Service classified Nauvoo as, quote, "a site of exceptional value commemorating and illustrating the history of the United States." In Salt Lake City, J. Leroy Kimball, physician and visionary urging church leadership to restore Nauvoo, capitalized on this national recognition for the city. In December 1961, he drafted a report entitled An Outline for the Restoration of Nauvoo, which cited extensively the National Park Service study, linking his vision for the city to that of the Park Service. The partnership between the church and the Park Service was born. Following his lengthy tenure, Conrad Wirth was replaced as National Park Service Director in 1964 by George B. Hartzog, who led the service from 64 until 1972. Hartzog assumed leadership of the Park Service from his position as superintendent of the Jefferson National Expansion Memorial downriver from Nauvoo in St. Louis, known today as the Gateway Arch National Park. Like his predecessor, George Hartzog expressed support for the Nauvoo project. In his first year as Park Service Director, Hartzog visited Nauvoo and reaffirmed his desire and the desire of the National Park Service to cooperate in any way, in every way, stating it was their intention to include Nauvoo in their overall plan of development, to furnish such information as will aid in the project, and to include Nauvoo in their literature in connection with the Jefferson Arch Memorial and their Mission 66 program. Arrangements were made to ensure that the Great River Road, then under development, would best serve the project's interests. Hartzog maintained correspondence with Nauvoo restoration leaders, calling himself, quote, an enthusiastic supporter of the project from its inception, end quote, while accepting invitations to represent the National Park Service at significant events in the city. In 1969, he joined church and national dignitaries at the groundbreaking for the church's visitor center, pictured here. This is Hartzog. 2 years later, Hartzog joined a similar cast for the building's dedication, where he also spoke. On that occasion, Director Hartzog publicly revealed National Park interest in Nauvoo. We of the National Park Service have watched with growing interest and admiration the unfolding restoration of this historic town, Hartzog declared. You have recreated here a vivid reminder of an important part of our national heritage, the setting not only of significant people and events of history, but of a past way of life too. You have harmoniously combined old and new in a model exhibition of enlightened historic preservation. Speaking of his own organization, Hartzog continued, our interest in historic preservation extends far beyond the historic sites we administer. In line with what we have termed the new federalism, we are also able to give help and encouragement to state, local, and private efforts. Our cooperative programs, featuring a partnership between the National Park Service and the private sector, are demonstrated right here in Nauvoo. The Secretary of the Interior has designated Nauvoo a National Historic Landmark, one of about 900 sites so honored to date as possessing exceptional value in illustrating the cultural heritage of our nation, Hartzog continued. Few places in the United States deserve this distinction more than Nauvoo. As the $1 million visitor center was being dedicated, the partnership between the National Park Service and Nauvoo seemed strong. So what happened? Why would a visitor to Latter-day Saint Nauvoo today find little representing the National Park Service? Similarly, why would someone studying the National Park Service find limited references to Nauvoo? In the years that followed Nauvoo's restoration heyday of the 1960s, both projects took dramatically different turns. In July 1972, George Hartzog wrote a complimentary letter to Harold B. Lee, offering, quote, his heartiest congratulations and good wishes on the occasion of his election as president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It has been a pleasure indeed, Hartzog wrote, for me to know and work with you in Nauvoo. If there is any way in which I may serve you at any time, please let me know. Lee responded, quote, it was with pleasure that I had the brief meeting with you with reference to work now being done in Nauvoo. I believe that the beautiful visitor center with a few buildings which have been restored as near as possible to their original state will provide not only a monument to the westward march of the early pioneers, but also to indicate to the visitors that those early members of the church were indeed people of refinement and culture, as their buildings and the work of their hands attested. And then President Lee concluded, please be assured that we would appreciate any further counsel you may wish to give us with reference to this or other projects which may come under your supervision. In spite of the overtures for continued cooperation, within 18 months, neither Hartzog nor Lee were directing their respective organizations. In late 1972, Hartzog was embroiled in several political controversies. Earlier in his administration, Hartzog had enacted the controversial practice of shuttering parks and monuments for 2 days a week in response to Vietnam War-era budget cuts. At the same time, Hartzog repeatedly butted heads with President Nixon over issues relating to the park, including denying a boat pass to one of President Nixon's closest friends. In December 1972, Hartzog was relieved of his duties, replaced by an official from the Nixon White House, signaling for some a shift from civil service to partisan politics within the Park Service. In the case of the church, leadership changes, including the death of Nauvoo supporter President David O. McKay, led to a shift in views. Even Nauvoo Restoration's founding, participants sensed that not all shared the same strong connection between Nauvoo and American westward expansion, preferring instead that the site be used for more traditional proselytizing purposes. In 1964, T. Edgar Lyon, a historical consultant to Nauvoo Restoration, wrote, "The road does not look too cheery, some opposition rising in the church." In 1971, the Board of Nauvoo Restoration was restructured, establishing even greater church control over the future for restored Nauvoo. A year later, a Nauvoo mission was created. Connections to the national narrative of westward expansion were pushed to the margins. During the 10 years of Conrad Wirth and George Hartzog, as well as church presidents David O. McKay, Joseph Fielding Smith, and Harold B. Lee, the National Park Service and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints maintained a shared active relationship regarding church historic sites. The arrangement was mutually beneficial for each organization. From the perspective of the National Park Service, Latter-day Saints represented a clean-cut counterpoint to the culture wars that engulfed America during the 1960s and 70s. The Latter-day Saints' story of bravely stepping out into the frontier during the 19th century melded with modern efforts to defend American exceptionalism while exploring space-age frontiers. For the church, cooperation with a federal organization like the National Park Service brought expertise and credibility to its historic site endeavors. It also allowed the church to drive the narrative for how their story would be told. National standing and interpretive control were especially important in a place like Nauvoo, where the faith story was inserted into the narrative of westward expansion, but also framed against alternative historical interpretations offered at neighboring sites. The relationship's demise reflects realities within both organizations. The National Park Service became more political, removing some of the strongest proponents for the partnership and making it increasingly problematic to cooperate in overtly religious projects. At the same time, church historic sites like Nauvoo became more religious, pushing evangelizing messages and later, through the reconstruction of the temple, shaping the site as a spiritual retreat for the faithful. However, for at least a decade during the 20th century, the National Park Service and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints worked hand in hand to make church historic sites, as the revelations in the Doctrine and Covenants state, a resting place for the weary traveler where they could contemplate the glory of Zion. Thank you.
So the English novelist, John Fowles, he has argued that our growing emotional and intellectual detachment from nature is perhaps the most dangerous of all contemporary forms of alienation. And I guess I wanted to start by saying that we go about our days having pushed out of our consciousness most of the intimate connections to nature that oftentimes would have been ever present for earlier generations. And living closely to the rhythms of seasons has given way to a more comfortable but severed relationship to the natural world. So oftentimes we see nature as conquest, or as a personal playground. And one of the happy byproducts, I think, of environmental history is it forces us to rethink these connections that are these ancient ways of thinking and behaving that that date back to our own, you know, tradition of Mormonism that we're talking about today and date back much further than that. I think that revealing the connections seen and unseen with nature, environmental histories help us see the ethical and moral dimensions of how we act in the world. So that's one plug for more environmental history at a conference like this. The other, of course, is obvious from the papers that were presented today is that they really do provide, each one had very good and specific insights to the topic that it was addressing. And I found all of them to be very useful. I have 2 minutes to talk about each one, so I'll just take them one at a time in the order that they were presented. So Duane Coleman, He argues that Joseph Smith and other early Mormons communed in nature. They sought it for personal inspiration by retreating to the woods, for instance. And they also sought it for their community by planting their homeland on the edges of the frontier. And that's a Turnerian idea, of course, unmistakably associated with westward migration. So Coleman contends, quote, "On the borders of the American wilderness, the experiment of a new American religion developed." So among the threads to follow then in your piece is this idea of personal inspiration of being in nature and the larger community project of discovering and transforming, quote, "a new pristine environment in which to commune with God." And excellent piece. I look forward to seeing a larger work on this. One thing to consider, perhaps, is the more specificity the types of landscapes that early Mormons sought. So Smith may have perceived to be in a pristine wilderness environment, as you note, but neither the Sacred Grove nor Greenville, Indiana, nor the woods outside of Nauvoo were in fact pristine. And what strikes me about your work is that Joseph Smith was continually looking for these ancient artifacts, these mounds, which is not so much pristine. He was looking for a deep human past. Contrast that with Brigham Young. I think one reading of him entering the Great Basin was that he was looking at a landscape that was beyond history. There was a blank slate on which he could imprint his mark. And maybe there's a contrast there to explore. And you can use the as a frame, consider William Cronin's first nature versus second nature, or this idea of hybrid landscapes that Paul Sutter and others have emphasized. And also, I just want to mention that your mention of swamps and sickness, I think that's a fertile field of study, is the body and disease, and more of that needs to be done in Mormon studies. But turning to Nate's paper, perhaps no subject is as widely treated in Western American environmental history as water and the lingering consequences of the hydraulic society that Widtsoe so assiduously promoted. And his statement that the destiny of man is to control the earth is hyperbolic, as hyperbole of what is central to the early Mormon environmental ethic and the animating energy of the reclamation movement, this idea of ordering the landscape and putting it to human use. So Nate, I really think this is a contribution to the literature of water, because it's almost impossible to overstate the significance of the compact in the development of the West. And I'm rather surprised at just how much Widtsoe's imprints were all over it, actually. So not something to downplay, I think. As modern observers, we can clearly see Widtsoe's blinders, his overextension of water in the system, his insistence that agriculture is the highest use, his idea that return flow would add significantly to the system, his definition, his narrow definition of what beneficial use actually is. And some of his ideas were contradictory. He was a proponent of prior appropriation, but clearly he also valued the Mormon communal system of water management, and oftentimes those two conflicted. And above all, I think, as you point out, it was naive for Widtsoe to advocate for a first-in-time, first-in-right distribution, given that his own state that he represented clearly didn't have the resources to develop. So, yeah, excellent piece. We can talk more about it later, I guess. In the next essay, Rebecca Anderson addresses Mormon regionalism, this notion that the work of Florence Merriam, Zane Grey, Wallace Stegner, and other local color writing helped to form in the minds of outsiders and insiders alike a distinctive Mormon place. And here again, we can evoke Turner and the long historiography of sectionalism, regionalism. I would point you to, more recently, the work of Robert Dorman, Hell of a Vision, and perhaps even more specific to the area that you're looking at, Thomas Harvey's Rainbow Bridge to Monument Valley. But I'm fascinated by this two-way association between land and identity formation. Wendy Griswold's notion that cultural expressions congeal around geography. And as Rebecca shows, a number of writers across generations have associated Mormon social and religious expression around the arid country of the Colorado Plateau, an association that I think is dominated by nostalgia. I wonder if there's an element of the othering to distinguish the Mormons who are then becoming mainstream. But anyway, this association was built on a pioneer myth that dates back to the 19th century, that Mormons had transformed a barren landscape, and Gray and Stegner bought wholeheartedly into this myth, as did Devoto and Edward Abbey. And I think that they were wrong. One, that Mormon villages were widely planted where the Fremont Indians had previously thrived, so Mormons weren't the only ones who could survive in this landscape. And two, the Mormon hold in the Canyon Country was often quite tenuous, and they had to abandon the quintessential Mormon practice of agriculture in order to make it work. But that's all peripheral to the broader point that you make, that the Great Basin and much of the Colorado Plateau came to be known as Mormon country, and the brilliant observation, I think, that the church's recent bucking of the moniker Mormon stems in part from the term's narrow place-based associations and connotations. And I would say in a world where regional differences are often muted, having these distinctions, if only through monikers, is something to hold on to. And finally, church-state collaboration in the curation of national historic sites. Scott Esplin's refers to this park-centered patriotism that prompted Latter-day Saints to partner with the National Park Service in the preservation of Nauvoo. And the intent was clearly to stake a place in the American mainstream, but also ownership of the church's historical narrative. And the problem was that the church, at least my reading of it, is that the church and national park representatives often had these different conceptions of what that narrative should be. So for the National Park Service, Nauvoo's significance lay in its relationship to the story of American expansion and westward migration, and less to the religious innovations of the Mormon people and faith. And here again, we see this question of differentiation. Church historic sites are unavoidably specific to a particular place and time, and yet the message being conveyed is more denominational and universal. So I just point you to maybe another example that you can use. By the way, I didn't know about this Nauvoo collaboration. I think it's really, really useful and insightful. And there's another one that's happening right now, trying to make the Hole in the Rock Trail a traditional cultural property. And the same concerns there are coming to the fore, in the sense that my reading is that the attempt by descendants of the Hole in the Rock pioneers is to make this designation that acknowledges what they claim is primarily a religious story and of sacrifice and faith. The problem is that the Hole in the Rock route passes through public lands, national park lands, and BLM lands that are public lands designated for multiple use. So the designation, this is a traditional cultural property designation, would possibly close off a portion of those lands to other uses outside of this faith and sacrifice designation. The other problem in my mind is that the Hole in the Rock story is not just a religious or church one, it's also a Western and a cultural one. So anyway, that might be interesting to follow up on. So to end with some connective tissue, John Fowles, he also writes that that we see nature as unphilosophical, well, that nature is, in fact, unphilosophical, irrational, uncontrollable, incalculable. And it seems to me that a major theme of Mormon environmental history is this idea of ordering and categorizing nature to fit our needs, that we mediate, we curate our experiences and associations with the environment, whether it be seeking out or manufacturing landscapes conducive for inspiration, or seeing arid lands as a blank canvas to realize a religious and cultural vision, or disassociating a people to a name that has been seared into a particular place, or curating the visitor experiences at a historic site. So, thank you.